Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Merv Field, who is the founder of the San Francisco-based Field Research Corporation and its Field Poll. He is the 2012 recipient of the Institute of Governmental Studies Darius and Sarah Anderson Distinguished Service Award. Merv, welcome to Berkeley.
Good to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
And looking back, how do you think your family shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, it happened that my mother and father were ill, and I was in an orphan asylum for the first couple of years and then raised by an aunt and uncle till I was about 15.
And did that make you, make you more self-centered about getting on in the world?
Yes, I would say people say that I developed street smarts very early.
And as you were growing up, were public affairs and elections something you focused on either in school or as a young person where there was conversation around the dinner table where you were living?
No, it's not that, but I just had an interest. I remember in 1928 in Herbert Hoover against Al Smith. I was 7 years old, and I was promoting Al Smith.
And when in your career did the idea of knowing what people think about coming elections or the candidates in the race, did that interest peak very, very early, or did it only come later?
It came when I was 16 years old, and I happened to meet George Gallup in Princeton, New Jersey, and I became fascinated with the polling method and the mechanics of it. Just it was sort of thrilling, and that's what I often say. I was infected with the idea of survey research.
And what year would that be?
1937.
And is that the beginnings of polling as an established craft?
Yes, it was in the mid-30s when George Gallup and Arch Crosley and Elmer Roper developed their shops, and then it took off from there.
And in a way, we can say that your life is the story of. Learning about the world and disciplines by teaching yourself.
Yes, it happened that I don't have any real formal education. I have a few college credits, but I've a self-studier, and I now like the term autodidact. And as a result of not going to college, which I wanted to do very much, it's made me a lifelong student.
And was quantitative activity something that you did well? Because clearly polling, really at the heart of polling, is the manipulation of data and numbers.
Yes. Well, what started, the mechanical aspect of survey research was what appealed to me, the idea of questionnaires, talking to maybe 1,000 people. And if you talk to them systematically and the sample was good, you could project it to a much larger universe. And that was thrilling to find out that you could do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you served in the Merchant Marine during the war?
Yes.
And what was that experience like? What did you get from being on a ship and having a lot of time on your hand?
Well, I entered the Merchant. I became a cadet in Merchant Marine Academy in 1942, and I was an unlikely sailor because I couldn't swim. I had never been in boats, and I was a real city kid. And it was wartime. It was the Merchant Marine. It was scary at first because the Nazis were just sinking merchant ships, and the Merchant Marine lost more men proportionally in the first couple of years of the war than any other branch of service. But what it did, it allowed me some time to study, and I would bring books, texts, And I had worked for a research company just prior to the war, and was in Princeton, New Jersey, and I was able to get help and materials and guidance for them while I was in the Merchant Marine.
And you were telling me earlier that being on a ship allowed you to play cards in your spare time. And so what came out of that that affected your future?
Well, we'd play poker, and I didn't think I was that much of a poker player, but I was not as wild as and venturesome or some of the other players. So I was winning. So at the end of the war, I had a stake of a few thousand dollars that I'd won in poker, and that gave me a cushion to start my own research company.
Mm-hmm. Now let's step back a minute and talk about this early relationship with Gallup. What exactly did that firm have you do in the beginning?
Well, the first meeting when I was not working for them, this was a chance occurrence, and again in 1937, when actually, as I say, when I got infected with the idea. Then in 1940, before the war, I worked for the Gallup poll and also another research company, doing interviewing, traveling throughout the country and Canada, interviewing people and supervising other interviewers. And that got me started on the basic rung of survey research, which is data gathering, which is interviewing.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little more about that. What that was like. You would get a list of questions from Gallup and his associates, and then you would go out and ask people?
They were based in Princeton, New Jersey. Three or four of us would get in a car, drive throughout the country, and it was called, we were an interviewer crew, and there'd be four of us in a car, and the sampling was very rudimentary, quota sampling, where we would be in a city, and I happened to be then the crew chief, and I would direct one interviewer to stop at this block, take so many interviews. I'd drop another interviewer, take so many interviews, and then the third interviewer. And then I would take a few interviews before I would then return and pick them up, and then we'd go on to another city.
And they would knock on the door, have a list of questions, ask the question, and then with pen in hand or pencil in hand, record the answers. Yeah.
Yes. The typical portrait was the interviewer with a questionnaire on a clipboard, and the respondent, either a man or woman, with the door front door halfway open, and the interview would progress, and that's how it was done.
Did you and the other interviewers have to have people skills? I mean, you're knocking on the door. Hey, here I am, a pollster. What's a pollster? You know, and then, yeah, come on in and have tea.
Well, see, this was at a time. This is, again, in 1939 and 1940 and 41, when at that time, public opinion research, survey research was very novel. And you would have to explain what you're doing, but people would be intrigued by it. And we could go in, and they'd invite us in. They might even feed us. And we would have long interviews, and we'd want to leave, but some of them would want us to stay. And it was a very nice situation. That has changed considerably now.
Right. So, okay, you then go into the service, and you have this bankroll. Or this money that you've acquired through your skills as a card player. So how did you wind up in California?
Well, first, the money, relatively small amount of money was done at the end of World War II in poker. And I wanted to come out to California. And the truth be told, I had met this gal during the war when I was stationed here at one time. And I had visions of a relationship with her. I had even proposed, and I came out, and I had met her in San Francisco, but she lived in Pasadena. So I set up my shop in Pasadena, in L.A., knowing that she was going to come down. But she married somebody else and not me.
Aha. But then you found someone and were married to them for 50 years.
Right.
Yeah. Your original idea was to start the Field Research Corporation. What was that, and how did the Field Poll emerge from that, and what was the difference between the two?
Well, the idea, you see, again, right after the war, 1946, when I set up shop, commercial survey research was still a novelty. And the idea was to describe the activity of survey research, how you could take a small sample of people and you could talk to your customers and your customers could tell you what they liked or disliked about your product, or you could test and advertise an advertisement and they could tell you what was good and what was not good. And you could take this 500, 1,000 people and again project it to the large body of the people that you're interested in. And the idea was that business then would utilize a survey research tool to help them in marketing.
Mm-hmm. And then, but the Field Poll, which emerged later, what year did the Field Poll emerge?
See, Field Research Corp was formed in 1946, and the Field Poll came in being in 1947.
And there the idea was to poll the electorate about their attitude about candidates and referendum issues?
The idea was to poll the people on public policy issues, social issues, and candidates. And the idea was to have that as something that the media would buy. And it would, again, be a demonstration of survey research in action. And as it related to election polls could validate the method. And, again, this would be a method that would be attractive to business. And so doing election polls, different than public policy polls, it was a case where you were out there and you had to get some measure. And if you're making a, let's say, a projection or a prediction of an election outcome, if your poll did not closely correspond in the results, then this would not be a good thing. This would be a black mark on what you're doing.
And you never became, in quotes, a Democratic pollster or a Republican pollster. You really were committed to objective analysis, and the measure of objectivity, I guess, evolved over time.
Yes. I felt that if while there are many opportunities to do research work for a candidate or a special cause, I wanted the poll, the field poll, to be independent, to be objective. And I felt if we had taken funds from somebody who had a particular interest in the election, that this would impair the idea and the actuality that this is impartial, it's objective, and not influenced by outside interests.
I like to ask my guests what skills go with the work they do in the way of advising students about how they should prepare for the future if they wanted to be a pollster. So what are the analytical skills that are necessary, and what are the qualities of character in this business?
Well, I'm often viewed as a statistician. Although I'm not a statistician, I have some understanding of arithmetic and numbers. Right now, survey research courses are being taught not only in statistics class, in psychology class, sociology classes, communication research, and it's one where interest in finding out what a public thinks about and adhering to the methodology of remembering that the whole idea of sample research is frail, and it's you got to be careful not to make mistakes or to sully the system. And so it's a combination of interest and disciplines.
And what about qualities of character? In other words, you must have to struggle for defining the questions and ordering the questions in such a way as to achieve objectivity.
Yes. See, one of the the activities that any good researcher does now in drafting a question. They play the devil's advocate, or there's someone along with them that's the devil's advocate, looking at a question. And you pose a question, and it might have some bias that's not intentional, but it's there. And someone will point out, well, that's a biased question. So one of the things that any researcher or pollster must do is to have that ability, either that ability himself or herself, to really detect the bias. But what happens now is if you do a poll and you have biased questions and it's published, there are legions of people out there will point out to you that you have a biased question.
Now, as your organization evolves, let's say you're dealing with a particular public policy issue, you come up with a set of questions. In your organization, did you create a seminar-like situation where your colleagues essentially critique each other's list of questions?
You would have that, and you would also have of a lot of reading. That is, if a subject would come up, we could say, you ask your question, well, what's been done about this? See, now with the computers and the internet, there's just a wealth of material. But it's probably, if you were a researcher and an idea came up, you could get on the internet, and within minutes of, you know, a short period of time, you'd have a wealth of material, of background material, and it was the kind of thing, before the computer age, it would take weeks and months of reading to come to the same point.
And so in this work, and it becomes qualitatively different over time, you really have to be pretty well informed about issues. First, you have to be able to say, hey, we need to do a poll on this. But then, let's say we're doing a poll on public health, you would really have to research the nuances of that issue area in order to then pose questions.
Again, we're in an age where it's much easier to do that than it used to be. For example, if you were a researcher and you were asked to poll on some subject that you knew nothing about, I would say within an hour or two going on the internet, you would you'd get a wealth of material. You'd become very well educated. What you'd find out, what other research are being done, the pros and cons of an issue, who's sponsoring it, and a wealth of material. So you could become well versed in that subject.
Now, this must create a whole new set of problems. When I was preparing for this interview, I was reminded of a heart patient who the doctor says, well, go home, you know, and monitor your blood pressure. The idea being that you should monitor it maybe once a day or once a week, but the concerned patient begins monitoring it every hour. Is this a problem in polling in the sense so much information, the rapidity now with which you can formulate a poll and kind of do it day by day almost?
Yes, but there's some issue. Yeah, there's some issues. For example, if they're talking about a political campaign, new issues come up and new events have an effect on the race. But on public policy issues, other issues, things get pretty well settled, and it's I don't think that, for example, on the issue of abortion, on the issue of, let's say, Obamacare versus those issues of their health care and things, all those issues have come up, and there'll be some new elements coming up, but I don't think you have to worry about being caught flat-footed by some new development.
To what? Let's look back again before the world of computers in the early stages. What was the big thing you had to watch out for so that you wouldn't err in the doing of your poll?
Well, let's go back to the way it all started in the late 30s. The situation was if you had Gallup or Elmer Roper doing a national survey, there would be perhaps 60 to 100 what were called resident interviewers living in the different towns and villages in the nation. they had been recruited by the company. They had been trained in doing some interviewing. Then in that, when a survey would come up, a questionnaire would be developed in the headquarters in New Jersey, New York, or wherever, and the questionnaire would be developed, and an assignment would go out to these resident interviewers. And instructions on how to handle the interview and how to handle this question. They would go out, and each interviewer might do 15 or 20 interviews. And if you had 100 of them, then they would you'd have a sample of, well 1,000, 1,500 or whatever. And but the situation was that it took time. See, at that time, a poll could be planned, let's say, on day one and tested in day three or four, then sent out to these interviewers by mail. And they would do the interview and would come back. And then you'd have what was called key punching of data and coding open-ended questions and then getting data. And it would be a 30-day elapse from the time you thought about the poll and actually getting data and reporting on it. Now, it's just, as you anyone can see, there's polling on any issue coming out daily, and that was planned and done and completed and reported upon in 3 or 4 days rather than 30 or 40 days.
Mm-hmm. And is there, how do I want to say, in the old days, conventional wisdom could be a problem. In other words, in because the time was so long in terms of actually implementing, doing the poll, and getting the results. Now it's as if there's a new conventional wisdom every week or something. Is there a problem there now that you see? Or
well, that's I think what you're describing is a function of how things operated a long time ago and the role of the media. Things weren't as fast moving as they are now. But what's occurring now is that you can do a poll on an issue in week one, do it and report on it, and some new development. You do another poll in week two. You can do it as fast, it's cheaper, and it's less cumbersome, much of a structure in the operation. And if there's some event, then you've got poll one and poll two. For example, I have an example. I'll stop. You know, I don't.
No, please. Go ahead, please.
Pardon me. Okay. Yeah. The example, for example, in a report that we have in the Republican nomination race in California. We started interviewing for a 10-day period in mid-February, and we found a big difference between in support for Romney versus Santorum. But a big event occurred while we were interviewing, in which Santorum won some caucus states and his star rose. And we saw a big change just in a matter of days in the preference for Santorum, where in the first half of our interviewing, Romney was ahead of Santorum by 20 or 25 points. In the second half of the interviewing, Santorum was within 5 or 6 points of Romney, so that we're able to make that move very quickly because we're doing interviewing by phone, and we were able to do it.
And now with the new technologies, cell phones and so on, one really can respond to a situation like that.
Oh, yes. See, now the apparatus is so handy for polling. You have cell phones, you have phones, you can have and there's now some cell phones that have been programmed to ask the questions and tabulate it themselves, you see, and where what the home office gets is a summary data within a short period of time after things start. No, it's the situation now is one where it's easy to do polling. It's still fraught with a lot of peril. The perilous elements now are different than what the perilous elements were 50 or 60 years ago.
What were the perilous elements 50 years ago? And then I'll ask you about the ones now.
At the start, well, again, in the late 30s, as I described, where you would have resident interviewers that were unsupervised. They may have been originally trained. They would get this assignment of, let's say, 15 or 20 interviews. And they're working on their own, and they would be out interviewing, and they were very conscientious people, and they would see that the response to the questions was a pattern. And they said, well, why do I need to complete the rest of these interviews? And so what happened, they would the term was cheating. Basically, they would fill in the questionnaire and see. And so that was a big problem, that we would get not reliable data. You see, we would get an interviewer might take a few interviews and then fill in the other questionnaires. And thinking they didn't think they were committing an error. They just said, this was I'm just getting the same pattern. Doesn't make any difference. So that was a problem. It was very difficult to ferret that out. So when you were a research manager at that time, the problem was this cheating element was very serious. Now the case is most of the interviewing is done by telephone in central location facilities that's being supervised. So there it's we're not worried about cheating. The big aspect is that we're originally – we would have not much trouble reaching people. Now, big trouble getting people to participate in the survey. And so the structure, the idea that we're getting a representative sample is maybe under some question.
And why is it that people are so busy or what that makes access to them difficult?
Well, people are busy and there's so much interviewing and polling and survey research going on, and unfortunately, the industry likes to interview at certain hours, which may not coincide with the time that the people are free. See, one of the biggest complaints we get is that, oh, you called me just as I was sitting down for dinner, and but there's so much going on, and and it's not novel. And people have been interviewed before, and they don't want to go through it again. And so you have a turndown. That is, they will not participate. And so instead of getting, if we draw a sample, again, originally, draw a sample where we could implement it, we could get 75-80% completion. Now we have to bust our buttons after numerous callbacks to reach these people and get them to participate. And so we have the problem that we get very low participation rate, which calls into question to whether we have something that is valid.
Your 50-plus year career in this business meant you had to adjust to new technologies, new issues, and so on. So I'm curious, what was there a time when you really made a big mistake in a poll that you call things wrong based on something you had done as opposed to changing events?
Yes, well, the classic boo-boo that will go to me and other pollsters to my dying day and their dying day was the 1948 election. It was the Harry Truman, Tom Dewey election. This is at a time when all the national polls and all the state polls were showing Tom Dewey ahead. And people believed that the race was over in August after the conventions. I had just started the field poll. This was our first test of the validation of the survey method here in California. And we had Tom Dewey ahead, but then we took a last-minute poll. Again, in this had to send the questionnaires out and had to take some time. So in our so the Thursday before the Tuesday election, the half sample, we found out it was a tied here in California between Dewey and Truman. And my first thought was, something happened. The interviewers made a mistake. It was not so much that you'd have to disbelieve the data, because if we reported a tie race or that Truman had a chance of winning in California, that you'd be laughed. So what I did was to go through, the 500 questionnaires that we had. With the raw data, what we had found was that it was 47.5 for Dewey, 47.5 for Truman, the other 5% for Henry Wallace. And it was a matter of 500 questionnaires. I personally went through every questionnaire to see if I could detect cheating. And I looked for questionnaires that were inconsistent. where you found a solid Democrat had voted for Roosevelt before, not voting for Truman, or vice versa, or somebody, consistent Republican voter, not voting for Dewey. But anyway, I found 12 questionnaires. I thought this was an error, and basically changed them from a vote for Truman, just hand by hand, made this horrible and unconscionable thing in one way, but I was not guided by anything other than where's the mistake? Got to find the mistake. So taking those, just those 12 questionnaires out of the 500, changing them from Truman to Dewey, instead of the 47.5 split, made it 50-45 in favor of Dewey. When that report came out, the reporter, the newsman called, the editors called and say, this is ridiculous. You only have Dewey ahead by 5 points. Well, what happened was that in the final result, in the race that Truman won California, 47.6 versus Dewey's 47.4. I had just moved the office from L.A. to San Francisco, and I had all these appointments set up to demonstrate to business people this marvelous tool of survey research. Couldn't cancel any of the meetings I'd set up because they wanted to tease me and to ask serious questions and also get a laugh out of this young kid that is trying to tell us to do the survey research, and he made this monumental error. But I just laid it all out, just described what it had done, and I said, it was a technician error, not that a technique error. The technique was right. The technicians did something that was wrong, but it turned out just by laying it all out and describing it that way, and it all got subsequently researched, it helped convey the idea that this was a tool that can work.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, actually, to talk a little about your philosophy, because from the very beginning, you actually at heart you're a pope. You seem to be a person focused on making democracy work. That you want to use these tools to actually listen to the people and figure out what they're saying.
Well, after the original fascination for survey research because of the mechanical aspect of it, I like that. But then as I was doing more and more research and seeing how people use it, how leaders use it, political leaders, legislative use it, could see where getting the public's view on a impending legislation or how a business would feel about some policy that they might start. And this, I could see how this was so helpful and that it was so important to get the public's view. And what the poll did was to bypass the people at the time who were what I would call self-appointed leaders. They'd say, my people think this. Well, we would do a research of his or her people and find out that what they said was different. So what polling did brought the public really into these public and legislative deliberations as to what was good policy. And that's still important today because what happens when you just have discussions of some issue, for example, let's take the abortion issue. Everybody believes that they're just pro-choice and pro-life. But within those segments, there are people who have different views, nuances that define that classification. So this is what polling and this is what survey research can do, is demonstrate that it's not a black and white situation or a division of people in different camps.
The field poll and the work of your research organization is highly respected. You're over the years you've been ranked as the number one pollster in the country. What was it like dealing with that role as Oracle? Because your audiences must want to find more information in you than you may have. So there must have been a struggle here to say, this is what I know, this is what objective research tells me, and beyond that, you know, I can't say any more.
Well, I just have to say we weren't ranked number one. We ranked high, and I think it would be wrong to rank any one of, I would say, 40 or 50 polling as number one. We're all doing good well, good effort. But in respect to the question, what the research can do, and in a typical situation is we do a report, a survey, and we present the findings. And a question might come from the receiver of the data saying, well, what if we do this? What do you think will happen if we do this? And the stance that I would take and any research manager would take is that we really can't contemplate that. Basically, you can make some guess, some estimate, but you can see what's going on. Now there's a lot of research where you can simulate certain outcomes, do the research, and see how people react to it. So you can do you're going to have different approaches to a problem and describe it in a survey research and then get a better idea of what would happen if the client, who's ever using research, what would happen if they tried to implement the findings with some policy.
You have been part of an effort, I think, to define a professional code of ethics for pollsters. What should the shape of such a code of ethics be for professional pollsters as they're responding to all the new technologies, to this array of agendas and so on?
Well, I was always interested in methodology and trying to maintain, this sounds a little overbearing, the purity of the method, see? It's just that the method should not be tampered with. And in I was a member of the American Association of Public Opinion Research, and I was always an advocate of strict standards. And I was appointed to a committee and worked with a lot of other researchers in the country and came up with a code of ethics for public opinion research, which got recognized in 1979, and I got an award for that. And basically what it needs to be done is that, like a lot of other activities, you need disclosure. That is, a pollster should not go out and do a survey and have findings and says, my findings do this. You see, if your findings are affecting some people, they have a right to see it. Moreover, if you are interviewing 500 or 1,000 people, each one of those respondents are partners in the effort. You see, things have to be disclosed. And disclosure is very important because then what you've done can be scrutinized, whether the question biased or not, was the arithmetic correct? You can then, because polls are very important in affecting policy, so the instrument and the findings and the package needs to be examined by anybody. And so that's what we've tried to do in the field poll, and it was this work in getting, and again, there was just many other researchers that felt the same way, which culminated into this very strict set of standards for public opinion research as advocated by the American Association of Public Opinion Research.
You've been taking the pulse of California since you came here. You remind me of the family physician who basically has insights about who we are and how we've changed. So first question, how has California changed since you first came here, and how have you watched it evolve?
Well, I think a demographer would answer that question better. Basically, it's one where a huge population, huge diversity, all sorts of people, coming. And California, particularly after World War II, is a huge microcosm of the country. One of the questions and discussions that have come up, why is it that people are not participating and not voting? And what the data shows is that larger and larger populations are not attending to what's going on in government or in affairs and not voting. And people will pull their hair out. Why is it that we don't have greater participation? I used to have what I would call a standard stump speech, where I would rail against this terrible trend, and we are becoming unrepresentative. But over the years, what I found is that we have a pretty stable system. That I've come around to the belief that if someone doesn't want to attend to what's going on, or doesn't want to vote, they have a right to do that. And the big question is, do they really affect adversely what's going on? And I think not. You see, one of the things that I learned, for example, or I've adopted, was that maybe half the people aren't participating and half the people aren't reading the newspapers, but I think it's the same half. See, and so what you have is the people who are participating, still a representative cross-section, and going on. And if the people who were not participating ever had a cause to do something, they can participate. See, except for certain occasions where you have street riots, we just don't have revolutions. And for example, now we in Europe and so many places, you do have near revolutions, near demonstrations in the streets, and so I think we can tolerate. What I would call a lack of attention. I used to call these people that didn't participate and didn't vote contented apathetics, and that is a good term. But it shouldn't. It's not an insult. See, it's one. The reason they're contented is that they know things would go well. And for a contented apathetic to start getting involved, it's taking time out of doing their daily things, working or taking care of the kids and things like that. And so it's a choice. And it's lucky that so many of us, that we have that choice.
So what I hear you saying in the course of this interview is that the best polling really is nuanced and subtle, and that over time you've come to see the complexity, and it always isn't the dire consequences that one might draw from that.
Well, it's just, you see, right now the media or in our discussions would describe somebody, people, as anti or pro on any issue. The one say one's a deficit hawk and one wants to spend money. But basically, when you look at all those issues and look at, let's say, spokesmen for these issues people who have, let's say, have adopted these positions, that's not as hard and fast as people would think. You see, there are deficit hawks that still want to spend money. There are people who reduce military expenditures, but they want certain kind of military expenditures. See, and so there's just so many, and particularly the issues are now more and more complex, and they need more study, and they need to be examined in detail, and polls do that.
You watched California leaders over this 50-plus year work that you've done in the state. Have they changed? Are they more subtle in their use of polls, or are you surprised by the ways in which they try to manipulate public opinion based on polls that they're receiving?
I don't think right now the leaders who may be taking polls are not out to manipulate the poll. What they may want to do, if they're so determined to take one position, to misread poll results. Or they may, unfortunately, there will be some pollsters that if I may say, are not upright, or they may be lacking in some methodological expertise, we'll do some polls that will fit a predisposed position. You may get that. But again, if you have disclosure, that kind of material and that kind of stuff can be exposed. And so, but I think it's just so much there's polls going on all the time. Every interest group in the state is taking polls on many issues, you see, and in respect to, for example, initiatives are coming up on to raise taxes. And different interest groups, they all want to raise taxes, but they want the money to go to different sources. And so polls may be taken where it's if it's serving one particular interest, it would see that interest is where the money should go. But enough polls are being done, and they're in conflict. You can examine them. And if you you can get all these polls as wealth of material, and an objective person can go through it and determine just what is so.
So if one hypothetically were doing polls on California attitudes toward Proposition 13, what I hear you saying, when we're doing that today, that there may be a greater nuance in some of the responses than, you know, just superficially the way sometimes the media reports?
Well, the Proposition 13 is still a hot issue. It's an issue that at the start was the one big nuance that was overlooked. There was also a Proposition 8. On the same ballot, which would tax businesses at a different rate, at a higher rate than Prop 13. That got passed, but it was overlooked. And call it inequities in Prop 13 that would create the situation where a homeowner on 123 Scott Street had the home for a long time. But his neighbor sold the house, the same kind of house, at 125 Scott Street, and their taxes are different. You see, that to me is a real inequity. See, and that still exists, and the people. But what is occurring is that I think there's people now recognize that we have to have more taxes, a more equitable form of taxes, and that's being tested. And particularly now, in the November elections, there are going to be a multiple number of tax issues, and the public's going to get involved. But we find now that there is now a sentiment. The public used to think that, we don't have to raise taxes. There's a lot of fat in government. And if these guys and gals in Sacramento would just do their job and get rid of this excess spending, this fat in the budget, things would be all right. That has changed. The public now recognizes that the government, state and federal and local governments need the money. And the big question is how should the money be distributed? And there's now a feeling that more taxes are going to be needed. And the big question is how that's going to be applied.
Over the years, you've done political surveys on public issues, but you've also done research for business as part of your organization. Is there a difference between different clientels and in different sectors of our society?
Well, a business will use survey research to find out how the public likes his or her product. What do they think of their advertising? What about their public relations? What about their employees, employee attitude studies? What do the community leaders think of us and this type of thing? But let's say getting back to just simple marketing research, early on, when a company would come out with a new product, we would it'd be test marketed. We'd get people to try it or they'd buy it, and then we'd interview them, find out that they either liked the product or they didn't like it, or they had a mixed view. They would like it if the elements were changed. There might be a package design that was well accepted or not accepted. If it's not accepted, what was it in the design that lowered acceptance? So all these decisions and the questions that business had as it relates to customers and their clients could be helped by doing survey research and getting a representative sample of the business's market and getting feedback. And again, it was done so easily. You could take 500 or 1,000 or even smaller groups, and you could test it out with smaller samples, and you could learn a lot.
And what about political leaders? Were they I know you don't do you're not a political consultant, but in other words, do you have any reflections on how they have tended to use the data about where public attitudes are on public issues?
Well, you have to separate, I think, political campaigns versus the everyday situation that a president or a governor or a legislative body has. In election research, unfortunately, you have research is testing the vulnerability of an opposing candidate or vulnerability of an opposing candidate's stand on an issue. And the research is done just very narrow, just very purposeful to determine, is this a good or bad thing? Is this something our candidate can use against the other candidate? And so it's very determined and very focused. On, let's say, research that's being done, as has been done for some time nationally and statewide, on what the public thinks of a variety of issues, and it's open, and there are different organizations. A lot of organizations are doing, institutions sponsoring research that will provide good data for policymakers. And it's ongoing, and there may be controversies. But again, if the findings and the material and the whole operation is disclosed, it has value. See, for example, I have people over the years I have gotten, someone would send me a report, and they would say, isn't this horrible? And it was a poor case of research. But I always had a view. So I would read through the report, and I would tell the person who asked me to review it. I said, I can always get some nourishment even out of bad data, you see, because it would provide some findings.
Let's use your experience and this intellectual journey which you've just described for us to sort of look to the future. Where do you think your discipline of polling will go in the future?
The big problem that polling and survey research has in the future is to deal with this problem of people not wanting to participate in the surveys. This is aligned with their idea of not paying attention to what's going on in government or voting. They don't want to participate in surveys. The novelty, it just was gone decades ago. And so getting representative samples is a big problem. This, you see, if the people in research in the future can't do that, then the whole basic methodology is under duress, you see. But what's happened is that the people coming into the research field now are very wise, good training, open-minded, and there's a lot of innovation going on to offset this decline in participation. Right now, we've always had to weight data depending weight samples to take care of non-response from certain groups. And now, with so much data available, that you can develop weights to see what you're missing so that you can plug them back into your sample, even though you haven't reached them, and still get a reasonable, valid finding.
One final question. How would you advise students to prepare for the future?
Well, in the survey research or just in their own life?
Well, in their own life, but that they are interested in survey research.
Well, I think it's the simplest. It would be never stop learning. Don't ever think to know it all. There's always something new about that. Always examine yourself. See, one of the things that I have done in research, I would tell myself and my people, there'd be a report, and I said, you've got to find the mistakes. You've got to find what's wrong with this report. We're in the mistake business. But being good people and good researchers, we got to find the mistakes and not assume that what we have is correct. And always examine and re-examine the method and not to be so sure that what you have found is the last word. The last word is not going to occur for some time in the future.
Well, on that note, Merv, I want to thank you very much for taking the time. This was a fascinating discussion of your work and the work of polling. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.